Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And on the third day, New Jersey postponed Halloween. Sandy on the broadcast today, some Freakonomics Radio, and for a change, the numbers from Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 31st of October, Halloween, of course. And this will be, appropriately enough, another dark and perhaps scary night for a good chunk of New York City. Canned food will be the norm, candles for light, battery-powered radios for news, and businesses still trying to make do. We sent Marketplace's Mark Garrison out into Lower Manhattan this morning.
Here in powerless Lower Manhattan, foot and car traffic is light. You hear little other than the sound of heavy pumps clearing out water. Moving uptown, there are a tiny handful of open businesses, including one in Soho that's actually well-positioned for the blackout.
Do you have crank radios?
We did have crank radios, but we're all out. Okay.
Power's still out at Eastern Mountain Sports, but the fit-friendly staffers are prepared with flashlights strapped to foreheads. Those headlamps are selling well now that everyone nearby is basically an urban camper. Sales rep Dave Bradford says he's gotten some new customers.
Folks that are definitely not outdoor people, definite Soho people kind of come in here. They're like a fish out of water. It's pretty amazing.
Still, the employees outnumber the customers, much like the nearby clothing store OMG. Flashlight-toting staffers help customers see jeans and jackets for sale. No power means no credit card swipes or working ATMs, so some customers who want to buy can't. Food is hard to find. A deli with staffers inside offered promise, but it turns out they were just throwing away spoiled produce. Dominic Guglielma, sick of crackers and PBJ, waits on a plate of lamb over rice at a food truck.
Finally, some warm food.
The cab ride back uptown is a bit more hazardous than usual with traffic lights out. Finally, a green light at Park Avenue and 40th. Glowing with the electricity, downtown businesses will need to revive. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
One needs no reminding, I imagine, that Tuesday is Election Day. Campaigns are making their last desperate push, trying to get their message out, mobilizing voters, which is kind of tricky when the power's out and streets are still flooded. In places that Sandy hit hardest, local officials are doing all they can to make sure the polls are going to be open come Tuesday. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
At this point, it's late in the game. Campaigns have already pulled the trigger on a lot of stuff. Craig Smith was President Clinton's deputy campaign manager in 1996.
You have tens of thousands of people already deployed in certain locations. You have mail bought. You have phone calls bought. You have television advertising bought. You have radio bought.
Staff, ads, all that is expensive. Smith says campaigns will do all they can to adjust their tactics.
You know, it's almost like sailing a boat. You know which way you want to sail, but, you know, the wind changes.
And boy, did it. Today, in the aftermath of Sandy, it was hard to get a hold of elections officials. Here's what happened when I called the Board of Elections in Camden County, New Jersey.
We're sorry. Your call did not go through. Will you please try your call again?
I probably heard that more than a dozen times as I called counties across the state. But I did get through to Stephanie Salvatore in Gloucester County, and she says they have a contingency plan.
We had paper ballots. We have books with voters' names if we couldn't get to a computer. The worst-case scenario, we would have been hand-counting all the ballots.
The county budgeted for that after 9/11. Paul Danini is on the Board of Elections in Mercer County, where the power is still out and there's a lot left to do. He's been delivering voting machines, making sure polling places are accessible. And he says he'll work overtime if he needs to.
With this curveball thrown at us, God only knows what the extra expenses are going to be.
Danini says he expects his county will apply for a FEMA grant to take care of those. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, look at that. There actually was something happening on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. And Dubner, you are in New York, and I'm going to guess that since you're on the radio today, you're warm and safe and dry, yes, from the storm?
I and mine are fine. We got very lucky. A lot of people obviously hurting in a lot of ways here, and all kinds of chaos in New York. Not surprisingly, the famous Village Halloween parade tonight has been canceled. It'll probably be a pretty muted Halloween everywhere on the East Coast, but we're still hearing from other parts of the country looking for answers. A listener in St. Louis named Vishal Dosanjh wrote to us with a Halloween dilemma. He has got an 8-year-old daughter named Sophia. She, of course, wants to go out trick-or-treating.
Of course.
But the neighborhood where they live is not so great. So here, I'll let Dad explain.
Right. I'd say it's on the higher end of a crime rate. There's not many people that are keeping their lights on Halloween night. You know, there's not many people that have Halloween decorations.
Now, little Sophia had made some observations based on Halloween's past.
Yeah, some neighborhoods give out more candy. I think it might be because maybe they have more money to buy candy or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. That's a pretty savvy 8-year-old, man. I don't think my kids could figure that out.
Exactly. And Vishal, her dad, wanted to know, so is little Sophia right? Do richer neighborhoods actually give out better candy on Halloween?
Yeah.
So we turn to John List. He's a University of Chicago economist who's done a lot of research on a related topic of door-to-door charitable giving. And he's looked at both wealthy neighborhoods and less wealthy neighborhoods. Here's what he had to say.
One of the best ways to go is to look for a community that is public-spirited and look for the wealthier parts of that community, and then to approach that community for your candy gifts.
All right. First of all, that takes all the charm out of it, right? I mean, if you got to get a spreadsheet out to go trick-or-treating, man, you're doing something wrong. But straight-up wealth is not what he's talking about, right? Don't go immediately to the richest places in the richest places.
That's right. There are other factors to consider. We also talked to the folks at Zillow, the online real estate database, which created a trick-or-treat index, actually, trying to identify the best trick-or-treating neighborhoods in the top 20 trick-or-treating American cities. Here is Zillow's chief economist Stan Humphreys.
From an economic perspective, we thought about children as kind of goal-maximizing automatons. What factors would you look at if you were trying to maximize your haul of candy on Halloween evening?
Goal-maximizing automatons. That I'm pretty sure I'm appalled, actually. What does Zillow have to say about how it constructs this index? I mean, what do they use besides home value, which is what they're known for?
Okay, so in addition to home value, they look at neighborhood density. It looks at a walkability score and crime data. Now, unfortunately, St. Louis, home of Vishal Dosanjh and his daughter Sophia, did not make Zillow's list of top 20 cities, but Zillow was good enough to run the numbers for us in St. Louis. And the neighborhood they came up with is St. Louis Hills, which is not too far from where the Dosanjhs live. It's got nice houses, close together, a good safety score. Here's Rick Bonish, who lives in St. Louis Hills. He says he and his wife spend about $300 on Halloween candy.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
I mean, we have 20 houses on each side of the block, and so every house is going to have somebody on their front porch giving out candy.
But what if you're, okay, this is going to sound terrible. What if you're like me and you just turn off your lights and pretend you're not home on Halloween?
On that block, you will stick out like a sore thumb. But that's actually the point. John List points out that, you know, while giving away candy on Halloween is such small stakes, it looks a lot like the other giving that he studies. And what he's found is that while we give in some part to be truly generous, altruistic, we give in larger part because we want to be seen as being generous.
That's so cynical.
And what we find is that for every dollar given, roughly 70 cents of that dollar is due to social pressure and 30 cents is due to altruism.
That's tough, man. 70-30. We've talked about this before, though. It's peer pressure, right? It's just really cynical.
That's exactly right. Kai, I do have a feeling that tonight, however, especially in the parts of the country where Sandy is hit hard, like here in New York, that 70-30 split might be about reversed because, you know, hardship really does bring out the best in us. So I have a feeling that tonight, the generosity and therefore the Halloween candy will be flowing. Hope so. At least my kids are getting ready to go.
There you go. If you live in New Jersey, by the way, Governor Christie has postponed Halloween. It's now going to be November the 5th, in case you're keeping track. So there you go. Stephen Dubner, he's back in a couple of weeks. Freakonomics.com is the website. See you, man.
Happy Halloween, Kai.
Yeah, bah humbug. Coming up.
I think I'm going to start producing a bumper sticker that says ghosts are good.
Scaring people as a business model. I'm not sure how I feel about that. But first, let's do the numbers. After a two-day storm delay, Wall Street reopened this morning and struggled to keep its head above water. In the end, the Dow Industrials fell 10 points, nearly one-tenth of 1%, closed at 13,096. The NASDAQ also shed 10 points, about a third percent, 2977. The S&P 500 added less than a point, basically flat, closed at 1412. For the month of October, the Dow lost 2.5%. The NASDAQ, get this, off 4.5%. The S&P 500 reversed itself 2%. Sandy gave a lift to some home repair and construction companies. Lumber liquidators gained nearly 5% as wood prices firmed up due to anticipated rebuilding. Lowe's tacked on 3.25% today. Home Depot added 2.25%. The biggest gainer among the blue chips, Walt Disney, was one of the Dow's biggest losers. It tumbled 1.9% a day after announcing a $4 billion purchase of Lucasfilms, creator, of course, of Star Wars, which means, by the way, I told you another Star Wars film is a bad idea. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for September. The Labor Department is scheduled to release its preliminary productivity and cost report for the third quarter. And some people revel in National Men Make Dinner Day. If your man is making dinner, don't interfere. Hey, how about tuna casserole? No, wait, I want steak. No, meatloaf. Meatloaf. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Hey, I changed my mind. Chicken cacciatore?
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Among the biggest problems New York City is facing today?
The city's way more packed than normal, obviously, because everybody has no choice but to use either a bus because there is no subway transportation or use a car or a taxi, and taxis are limited. And it's kind of like, what do you bargain with? You pay $40 or you sit here and wait for an express bus who knows when it's going to come.
That was Catherine Hernandez in Manhattan this morning. Her drive in from Queens today took 2 hours because there is epic apocalyptic gridlock in New York. Cars, cars, and more cars, which is at least a little bit ironic because thousands of cars were flooded by Hurricane Sandy, ruined, total write-offs, which means the owners of those cars are making calls to their insurance companies right about now. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Well before Hurricane Sandy made landfall, insurance companies were preparing for huge numbers of insurance claims.
We have five of the MCCs, as we call them. That's our big RV.
Justin Herndon is a spokesperson for Allstate Insurance. Those MCCs, or Mobile Command Center RVs, allow claim adjusters to get to customers as soon as people are allowed back into flooded areas. Right now, Allstate has about 1,100 adjusters out in the field looking at flooded cars and taking very detailed notes.
We're going to try to repair the vehicle first, and if it's not economically feasible to repair the vehicle, then we're going to settle the auto as a total loss.
The distinction is a big one for consumers. An insurer may consider a car salvageable, but water damage can significantly lower its resale price.
There could be water residue that's hiding to cause problems later down the road. Rust could end up being an issue. There's just an untold number of problems that could arise down the road.
Alec Gutierrez is a senior analyst with Kelley Blue Book. He says that a car that has been through a flood is usually given a rating of poor, which is so low the Blue Book doesn't even give it a price.
They're going to have quite a difficult time getting those vehicles sold for the fair market value that they're going to be looking for.
That wasn't the case a few years ago. Now it's easy for customers to get a vehicle's history, repairs, accidents, water damage, thanks to services like Carfax, which, coincidentally, expanded to consumers the year after Hurricane Katrina. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
It's been almost 20 years now that the North American Free Trade Agreement has been around. People can and do disagree about whether NAFTA was a good thing or not, but this much is true. Since it was passed, exports to Mexico from states like Texas and California and Michigan have shot up. But not every state has been savvy about promoting cross-border trade, including Arizona, which seems Kind of surprising. From the Fronteras Project in Phoenix, Arizona, Peter O'Dowd reports.
Let's begin 250 miles south of Arizona in the Mexican port city of Guaymas. Behind me, the Sea of Cortez shimmers in the distance. In front of me, a backhoe dumps powdery black ore onto a conveyor belt. It leads to a humongous cargo ship.
You can see we are loading a ship with copper concentrate that comes from Arizona, and we're shipping to China.
Guillermo von Borstel is a port spokesman, explaining how Mexico links the southwestern U.S. to the rest of the world. NAFTA's presence here has boosted the confidence of American investors, and it's helped the port grow. Van Borstel says long-term plans call for additional docks, and early next year, a new container service could ship even more goods, up to 10,000 containers a year from Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas.
That's a relatively small amount, yeah?
Exactly, it's a small amount, but that's why we are on the beginning of this journey.
It's the beginning of a trade journey for states like Arizona as well. The Guaymas port is at the southern end of something called the Canamex Corridor, a high-priority transportation route from Canada down to the U.S.-Mexican border in Arizona. When it came to life nearly two decades ago with NAFTA, the corridor was intended to, quote, harvest the benefits of increased trade. While states like Texas and California have seen benefits from similar trade routes, not so much in Arizona. Darren Henderson is a transportation planner in Phoenix.
If you look at it as a football analogy, you know, we're just an expansion team. You know, we're just getting ourselves into the game.
In fact, Arizona is one of just three states since 2006 to see foreign exports fall. In that time, Texas exports are up 66%. Henderson says Arizona needs change.
We need to move away from being one-dimensional, focused on the construction of housing, and look at what other opportunities present themselves.
This jet flying over the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport represents one such opportunity, according to Suzanne Kinney. She's with the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
It's really a vision that we have for our state to make Phoenix the hub of commercial activity and international trade for the southwestern United States and to include northern Mexico.
Here on the outskirts of Phoenix, land is plentiful and industrial buildings are still empty after the real estate bust. The Chamber's idea, use that space to build something like Fort Worth's Alliance Global Logistics Hub with all sorts of transportation goodies.
Freight forwarders, logistics companies, warehousing, customs brokers.
The Fort Worth hub is considered the gold standard for connecting U.S. manufacturers with the rest of the world. Kinney says Arizona could take note and intercept foreign cargo that normally passes right through Arizona. Much of it would come from or be delivered to Mexican ports.
They'll be able to bring these massive cargo ships in, and then it's a matter of that transportation infrastructure, highways and rail, to get it the rest of the way.
And that's what has regional planners from Tucson to Phoenix salivating. Groups of cities are commissioning freight and rail studies. The Transportation Department is holding meetings on a new interstate between Phoenix and Las Vegas. John Barry is Air Services Manager at Gateway Airport. He says this connectivity must be part of the state's future.
It has to be. I think if Arizona wants to compete in a global market, it has to be.
But Arizona isn't the only state with big plans. Just a few miles from the border, Union Pacific has already broken ground in New Mexico on a freight logistics center worth $400 million. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
So, riddle me this. What's a business to do post-Sandy? Open back up, obviously, when possible. Figure out how to deal with waterlogged merchandise, probably. And then try to tie their products and services to the storm somehow to boost sales? And if so, how? Without coming off crass and tasteless. Sally Herships reports that's a very fine line.
Since Sandy hit, lots of companies have been reaching out to homebound consumers. Anthropologie offered what it calls high and dry, safe inside free shipping. American Express sent out an email to storm-stricken cardholders offering emergency financial and travel assistance. Then there was the email from American Apparel promoting a Hurricane Sandy sale,
offering 20% off in case, as the email says, you were bored during the storm.
When I saw it in my inbox, I was completely shocked.
Whitney Hess is a user experience consultant. She helps companies understand how their web presence impacts consumers. There was a huge backlash to American Apparel's ad on Twitter.
They make no mention of thinking about those who are affected, and it just demonstrates such a lack of empathy.
American Apparel said it wasn't trying to make light of the situation. The company says it has stores up and down the East Coast, and Halloween is normally their busiest time of the year. But by trying to mitigate its losses, it may have caused a larger problem. Sanjay Dhar teaches marketing at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He says American Apparel should have offered to help its customers.
I think it would have made a big difference.
Dhar says the younger customers who shop at American Apparel are focused not on money, but on changing the world. He says it's important for brands to think about the tone of their ads and know what their target audience wants. American Apparel says it will be donating clothes to storm victims. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Trick-or-treating is on hold in some parts of the Northeast, as Dubner and I were talking about. Elsewhere, though, it's business as usual. And by business, I do mean business. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the haunted economy.
I'm walking up a set of narrow stairs at the Shanley Hotel in Napanock, New York. I'm here to see a ghost. The Shanley claims to have dozens of them. Two angry gangsters on the second floor, a lady in white on the third floor, and here, in a part of the hotel that used to be a brothel, Anna.
Anna, are you in here? Want to turn that flashlight on?
Tour guide Amy Daniels takes out a small flashlight that twists off and on.
And you set it up just right where it doesn't take much force to actually flip the light on and off.
Daniels sets the flashlight on a nightstand in the room where Anna used to work. And a few minutes later...
Anna's here. The flashlight just turned on.
Yeah.
It's called flashlight play, a basic technique when you're hunting ghosts.
Can you turn that flashlight off now, please?
Oh my gosh, it turned off.
That's just one of the paranormal activities guests take part in at the Shanley Hotel, which has been featured on reality shows like Ghost Hunters and Ghost Detectives. Owner Sal Nicosia bought the 19th Century Inn in 2005. He planned to turn it into a coffee shop until he and his partners started hearing footsteps and seeing orbs.
And it just turned it, for what I wanted to really do with the place, into a complete different direction.
Instead of coffee, Nicosia sells the paranormal. The paracurious come from all over the country, hoping to hear a disembodied voice or feel a ghostly cold spot. The rising popularity of ghost hunting has helped turn cold spots into cold hard cash for thousands of small businesses and even some cities. Joseph Marinelli heads Visit Savannah.
I think I'm going to start producing a bumper sticker that says ghosts are good.
Savannah was named the most haunted city in the U.S. by the American Institute of Parapsychology. Marinelli says the benefits have been very real.
With more and more of those ghost hunter type shows on television, we have seen an increase in number of people coming to Savannah specifically for that type of tour.
Marinelli says a major chunk of the city's $2 billion tourism business comes from ghosts. All over the country, businesses are rising up to meet the demand. One tour outfit in New York, Ghosts of New York Walking Tours, went from 300 customers in 2007 to 10,000 customers last year.
It's the in thing these days, you know. Everybody wants to be a ghost hunter.
Willie Hassel drove for 5 hours to get to the Shanley Hotel with his ghost hunting team, Spirit Chasers Paranormal. The team has organized its whole night around avoiding the Shanley's other guests, at least the ones made of flesh and bone.
You see, we got three recorders running right now, but all the time we hear people downstairs laughing and walking around. It's noise contamination. It's very frustrating.
Do you find amateur ghost hunters annoying?
Yes.
At Joe's room, this is his actual chair.
The disembodied...
Annoying maybe, but amateur ghost hunters bring in real money. The Shanley books up year-round, and the guests pay whether they see ghosts or maybe just their radio equipment bag in the mirror.
The curtain's moving, right?
Oh, it may be you moving.
It's me.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
One last thought on the way out today from the Say What You Will About New Yorkers file. They can be cranky and rude, always in a hurry. They talk a lot, too, but they don't let nothing get them down. We caught up with Tanya Lamel after a long, long commute into work today.
First, the traffic was annoying me. Then I realized the determination of the people to get into Manhattan at any cost. And that really kind of warmed my heart a little bit. Like, oh, we're going to keep going. And this little rainstorm is not going to stop New York. So.
No, it's not. Tell us how you're doing, storm or otherwise, on our Facebook page. Or you can just drop us a line, letters@marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 10 points, nearly a 10%, closed at 13,096 after two extra days off. The NASDAQ also off 10 points, a 3%, 2977. The S&P 500 added less than a point, basically flat, 1412 the number. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.